So what if I was like sitting across the table from you? I was like, Angie, I really need you to take 3 bites of this. And you're like, I don't eat that. And I'm like, I'll give you a cookie.
This is Mayo Clinic on Nutrition, a podcast from Mayo Clinic, where we dig into the latest nutrition trends and research to help you understand what's health and what's hype. I'm Tara Schmidt, a registered dietitian with Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. This episode, how childhood habits shape adult eating. When it comes to food, we might know what our habits are, but we don't always know why our habits are. Sometimes to get to the bottom of our habits, we need to go back to where it all began. Childhood. Parents, caregivers, and other authority figures teach kids lessons about food. They might label certain foods good or bad, or kids pick up on how the adults in their lives eat and talk about food. And a lot of those ideas stick. But are those habits and attitudes locked in, or do we have the ability to change them? This episode, we're going to revisit the ghosts of meals past and find hope for our future eating. And here to help me is Dr. Angela Madke. She's a pediatrician with Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, specializing in eating disorders. She also hosts one of our other podcasts from Mayo Clinic Press, Mayo Clinic Kids. Hi, Dr. Madke. Thanks for being with me today.
Thanks, Tara. Thanks for having me. Please call me Angie.
You get to be the guest, not the host today, so I don't know if that feels weird to you or not.
It's very weird.
Today, we are talking about childhood eating habits and what happens during childhood. How do we transition into making our own decisions as teens and even adults? And now some of us are parents. How do we not screw up our kids? It's overwhelming, I think.
It is very overwhelming.
Do you remember anything from your childhood or adolescence that was nutrition advice that was absolutely accepted in society? And now you think, like, who said that?
Yes, there are several. The first is we had juice like all the time.
That's on my
all the
list.
Time. So much juice. I don't know how. I don't, one, have more cavities. And two, I don't know how my dad doesn't have diabetes yet with all the juice that we drink. And then the second thing is like the 90s low-fat, sugar-free foods, the cheese, the ice cream, the cottage cheese, everything was like fat-free. And it was just like, I hated milk because I only was offered skim, but I got to experience whole milk.
And whole is delicious. Yeah.
With like all of the fat in it. I was like, this is amazing. I probably wouldn't have osteoporosis as an adult now if I would have had.
No one gave this to me. I was told, I swear to goodness, that the crust of the bread was healthier. Like, parents have told kids, like, well, you have to eat your crust at school because there's more nutrition. I'm like, those are just the edges that were touching the pan. What are you talking about?
I've heard this before, but I also know culturally, it's like really important to be able to get the, what do they call it? The butt?
Oh, like the heel? Yeah.
Yeah, the heel. It's like a significance of like honor to be able to get the heel of the bread in some societies too. And so, yeah, you should feel like you missed out. But I think because my mom was so health conscious, I also grew up really kind of health conscious, which I think can be a good thing, but also can be a bad thing, right? If the focus is always on nutrition, like you can create eating disorders. It's a really narrow and fine line to walk. Like, how do we promote, you know, nourishing our bodies and nourishing our brains and building strong and powerful bodies is the language that I use with my family and with my patients, but not make it a good and bad dichotomy. And only one size of body and shape is the ideal, and that we don't have room for lots of different varieties of bodies and shapes and ways to keep our bodies strong and powerful.
Yeah. I like to use the word neutrality about food. Like, I would like us to be neutral about cookies.
That. Yes.
It's just a cookie, right? It's not good or bad. But we also can't survive on just cookies. So it's really, like you said, it's a fine line. So moving into how we develop our eating habits, our eating beliefs, do you want to talk about just kind of habits in general, especially related to health decisions or practices of health?
I think it's really good to take a step back and do reflect about like, where do our habits come from and which ones were from childhood? And I think a lot of times we split habits into good and bad, right? Habits are just part of good routines. And all of us thrive off of routines. They're good for our brain. They're good for our bodies. They're really good for our emotional regulation. For all you out there who have kids and you change the routine and you change the habit and your kid is like losing it.
Meltdown.
That's why. Exactly. We thrive off of it. And it's not just little kids, but it's in adults. And so having habits that promote benefits help us lead healthier lives. But some habits can cause harm, right? Some habits can lead to addictions and other things that can be really, really hard on our brains and our bodies long-term. And they're really hard to make and they're really hard to change. And I think people get really down on themselves when they're trying to make a new habit and they're struggling with it, but it takes so many different times doing it, thousands of times to really get it as part of our routine. Tara, why do habits develop?
I'm not a psychologist. I'll just put that out there, but I do work with them. An activity that I actually do a lot in office is stimulus response reward. Stimulus in terms of, is it an environmental stimuli? Is it an emotional? Is it a time? A lot of us just have straight up time-based habits. I come home from school and I eat my snack in front of the TV because, I don't know, that's what I'm supposed to do. But if you have a stimuli that leads to an activity that leads to a reward, your brain remembers that. And then it kind of goes in this loop-de-loop of when I get triggered again with that same stimulus, and I can remember what activity I used to get the reward. You're going to do it again. It's easy, and your brain remembers that loop. So to break it is difficult, of course, but you either have to stop at the stimulus or at the trigger, and sometimes you can't, right? Like, there are goldfish in my home. There are likely to be goldfish in my home for the next few years, so I'm not going to decide not to buy them, right? But I can decide that I'm going to pack my lunch for work instead of pretending like I have to go get sushi because I forgot my lunch. And you can also change, of course, how you respond to said stimuli, but you have to get the same reward, right? So if I'm like, I'm not going to eat chips and drink wine after work anymore, I'm going to eat carrots. Like, no, thank you. The reward of my wine and my chips was I felt relaxed. Carrots isn't going to cut it. So if you're going to replace your response, you have to get the same rewards so that your brain is driven to do it again. So if I really don't want to drink wine as a transitional habit or to relax at the end of my day, I'm going to go read a book. It will give me relaxation. It will give me pleasure because I'm a book nerd. And that's an actual loop that I can handle and that one that I actually truly will enjoy. And if you can stop the stimulus, I've had a patient who took a different route from work to home so that she did not pass a fast food restaurant. And if you don't have that, in her case, visual stimuli, like, all right, then we didn't even think about it sometimes. If there's not ice cream in your freezer, you may not have enough energy to get yourself up and get your coat on and get in the car and drive to the grocery store and walk to the freezer section and buy ice cream. But if I have ice cream in the freezer, pretty dang convenient. Can you think of habits that you feel like people may have been taught in childhood that end up as habits in adulthood that we would say are not our favorite?
Oh my gosh, so many. One habit we always did in my family, though, we always sat in front of the TV.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, and we always ate our meal, and that was only because of my dad. But I think there's so many habits. So sometimes eating food to cope with emotions or trauma. Habits of like always having to clean your plate, right? How many of us heard that growing up in the
Clean Plate Club?
Yeah, 70s, 80s, 90s. Or telling your kids that they have to eat all their food in order to get dessert, or having to have dessert at every meal. And not because it was something we wanted, it just became a habit. Another habit that I see so many of my kids starting in middle school, they start skipping breakfast. And it's because they don't have enough time, or their peers are doing it, or all these other reasons. But even as adults, and that continues on, skipping breakfast, and it's such an important meal of the day.
If you're an adult and you don't want to have breakfast, fine, maybe you're a lost cause. But we do have a lot of research specifically about kids and their attention in school, right? And how well they can concentrate and how they actually do better on testing when they've had something for breakfast.
And I'm just going to throw in there, the other thing that helps with attention and focus and performance in school is exercise. So like, get your breakfast, go play on the playground, and then you're going to do better at school.
Absolutely. Where do you think other eating habits come from. So we have our childhood, of course. When we start to transition into making some food choices, I'm thinking like I had a little bit of cash, so I would go to the gas station and buy my favorite candy with my friends right after school. Any other influences you think that adults really assume?
That is a hard question. I do think they come from families. I think they come from marketing. I do think they come from societal norms, cultural practices, like all of those different things. And then there's also this whole other psychosocial aspect that come in to the food choices that adults make. So life experiences, exposures to new foods, new things. And then sometimes habits come out of necessity. So food insecurity, trauma, people experiencing homelessness, those different types of things. And so the habits change over time because they're working on surviving and other things.
We can talk and joke about habits that our parents instilled in us, but I like to make it really clear that all parents are likely doing the best that they can.
We're all just doing the best we can.
Just try to survive. And that good enough parenting, like the phrase good enough parenting, is actually a method in psychology. Mm-hmm. It means that you don't have to be perfect. And you don't really want to be a perfect parent because then your child doesn't know how to adapt to negativity. So it's okay. And our food environments are vastly different, right? So socioeconomic status comes into play. How many grocery stores are in your town? How many fast food restaurants are in your town? What does your pantry look like? Are your parents home during the dinner hour or are they working a night shift? So we want to have fun with this, but we are certainly not blaming parents because at every stage of life and at every generation, we've been doing what we think is best.
Exactly. Give each other grace.
So our brains like habits and routines. They keep us happy and our emotions stable. And our brains are pretty smart. They learn that if we do a certain activity, we get a reward. Like how eating ice cream in front of the TV at night is so satisfying and relaxing. Once those connections get wired in our brains, they're really, really hard to change. And we start making those connections when we're young. Even doctors and dietitians have stories about how we ate as kids that make us absolutely cringe. But we're not bringing these stories up to blame anyone. It's just so we can start to build awareness of what we learned and understand how it's not helping us anymore. So let's learn more about ourselves, about our kids, and go deeper into what influences how kids eat. We know that kids really pick up on their parents' habits, good or bad, right?
Oh my gosh.
They're actually the biggest influence, especially on eating and exercise-related habits. Like, this isn't about looking at your favorite celebrity or football player on a commercial eating or drinking X. Mm-hmm. Kids most often emulate their parents.
Oh my gosh, so much. What we do and what our kids are exposed to is going to develop their habits and routines that they're going to take forward for the rest of their life. I have had so many parents say to me, I don't like vegetables and we just don't serve them because I don't like them. So that's why they don't like them. And I was like, yeah, that is exactly it. I was like, you are so correct. And so it's a good opportunity for parents to role model trying things, experiencing things that they maybe aren't sure that they like or that they would like, and doing it with their kids and making it fun because they are going to emulate exactly what you are doing.
Yes, I've talked to my husband about this. Of if you say that broccoli is gross in front of our children who don't remember if they like broccoli or not, they will absolutely believe that broccoli is gross. And now they're not going to like broccoli, even though they may have. So I'm like, don't say it out loud.
Yes.
Just put it on your plate. You can say that it's not your favorite, but just zip it.
We call those thinking thoughts in our house. Yeah. We have speaking thoughts and we have thinking thoughts. And look, I 100% agree. There's probably things that I don't like, right? For example, meat. But do I serve them to my kids and let my kids eat them? Absolutely, right?
Yeah. And then as you experience, they get to make those choices, right? So parents get to decide what is offered. Parents get to decide how often. And in most cases, kids at least should get to decide how much, right? Not an unlimited amount in some cases, of course, but you get to decide if you take one bite or 10 bites. I will sometimes use the example of what if I did what sometimes we do to kids to you. So what if I was like sitting across the table from you? And I was like, Angie, Angie, I really need you to take 3 bites of this. And you're like, I don't eat that. And I'm like, I'll give you a cookie if you do.
Great. It's
so good. When people are trying to force their kids, like, would you like it if I did that to you?
Exactly. There was a lot of food waste. But even when food waste comes with it, box it up and put it in the fridge and give them that same thing the next day. It doesn't have to be a new piece of broccoli every single day, you know?
Yeah. The other one I thought of in terms of things that some parents did, again, this is not good or bad. It was just what happens sometimes, is rewarding with food. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely find myself like, okay, if you do this for me, I'll give you a sucker.
Right.
It's so tempting. My husband was rewarded with different kinds of ice cream by the number of goals he scored. So he scores 1 goal in soccer, he gets an ice cream cone. He scores 2, he gets a sundae. He gets 3, he gets a blizzard.
Oh my gosh.
He told me that and I was like, I can't handle that. He's like, I turned out fine, Tara. But very good example of rewarding the gift of food.
So I struggle with that because food is such an important part of celebration in our cultures. And so I think what you're showing is like a clear link between performance and reward, right? We like to go get ice cream like after a recital or a good game or things like that. So I think it's important to also separate that like ice cream happens even when things don't go well, right? When we learn through resilience and coming back from things that were hurt.
We don't have to say that ice cream is bad. We don't have to only have ice cream at birthday parties. We can have ice cream whenever you, the parent, decide to have ice cream. And that can be in your home if you want it to be more neutral. That can be on a random Wednesday and after a dance recital. Kids aren't in control a lot of their food choices, good or bad. But you as the parent are in control of how often a lot of these things happen. In terms of fad dieting, this is where I do get serious about parents and their influences on kids. But it's not just parents. It's the TV. It's social media. Now, we didn't have that when I was a kid. But I vividly remember that having fat-free yogurt, probably 4 ounces, was a meal because that was a diet at the time. Mm-hmm. Or a bowl of cereal. And I saw that as a kid. I did not see my parents do that, but I saw that probably on a commercial, I'm assuming. And that can have a big impact. That's scary.
Yeah, it definitely is scary. It stays with kids, right? Mm-hmm. My patients believe everything that they see on TikTok and other social media platforms, and they start to emulate it with practices that, frankly, are harmful, both emotionally as well as physically and nutritionally.
Do you feel like we still have some room for improvement as adults and for those of us who are parents? I think we're doing better, I would say.
Yeah.
And not better than my parents, just better maybe as a society.
Because I do work in the eating disorder world, I think everyone's trying to do their best. But what I see coming across as a presentation for some types of eating disorders like anorexia now is people just trying to be healthier. And so sometimes that's more socially acceptable if you're cutting out gluten or clean eating or doing all these other things, which again is just, it's like a rebranding for a fad diet, right? It's like they got a good marketing team and made it sound better. And so I think all of those things are still harmful, and they're really harmful for our impressionable young people that are making these habits like we're talking about to build strong brains and bodies for the rest of their life. Because it really does start to shape how they view what's considered a value. What do we value? What types of bodies do we value? What types of food and stuff do we value? And so I think as parents, we're trying to do better, but even parents that are trying to be healthier, we need to be conscious of what we're saying to our children and our teens as we're doing that, because they're internalizing a lot of it and they are emulating it. And if you're constantly talking about your weight and how you're not happy with your body and you're not happy with your shape, or even worse, you're pointing out other people's weights, shapes, and bodies in public, or if you're saying things to them like, oh, I wish I could eat that. I can't tell you how much I even hear that in my eating disorder clinic. They'll say things like that to them, which they don't mean to cause harm, but it does cause harm. So I think we all just need to give ourselves grace with what we eat, and we need to give other people that same grace and stop those judgments and stuff like that. And everyone's just trying to be healthier, but we all just need to make sure we're going about it in ways that are truly healthy for you and your families.
I think modeling is so important. So whether that's the things that you say out loud, the things that you say to yourself in the mirror. Whether or not you have kids is actually irrelevant, because I want you speaking to yourself either like you are your own friend or like you were as a child. And a lot of the things I think that we say to ourselves, we would never do that.
Yeah, exactly. Right? We would never say that to our best friend unless like yes. you have a serious problem with your ability to control your frontal lobe and things like that. But yeah, that's a really important thing that people need to start being kinder to themselves first.
So there are a lot of ways our parents may have influenced us, or how we influence our own kids. It can be overt, like trying to get kids to eat more than they want to, or rewarding them with a cookie. Or it could be more subtle, like parents saying they don't like Brussels sprouts, going on overly restrictive diets in the name of quote-unquote being healthy, or talking negatively about people's bodies. Most caregivers really do have good intentions, keeping kids fed, being healthy, or trying to teach kids how to make wise choices. But if we're not careful, we can also unintentionally send sneaky, subtle messages, ones that affect kids' self-worth and their relationships to food and their bodies. Untangling our habits and influences as adults can be difficult and healing. So let's explore how we move beyond childhood, disrupt old behavioral patterns, and create change. So do you feel like there's a transition between, okay, these were my childhood habits and this is the age where I get to start making decisions for myself and now I'm into adulthood? With food, is there a really important age that we need to be mindful of?
I think the preteen and teen years are the most important.
Sure.
You're not with your teenager all the time and they're making a lot of the choices on their own. But this is also the time that they're most susceptible to those criticisms. All they want is to fit in with their peers, right? And so they might be doing things that could be harmful or making habits that could be concerning. And so that's the time frame that we do sometimes see eating disorders develop and other things. I think also that kind of mid-20s, like 25, like your frontal lobe is fully developed. I think there's some evaluation that happens of their life and their habits and things like that at that point.
When we had habits as kiddos, whether they were instilled upon us or decided upon by ourselves, do you think that those are more difficult to break than habits we've developed in our teen or adult years? Because they've been around for so long.
Oh, 100%.
Are we stuck with our childhood habits?
No, I don't think we're stuck, right? So that's the great thing about being humans is we can constantly evolve and change and lay down new neural pathways and things like that. But I do think it's a lot harder to break. Just with any habit, the longer it goes on, the harder it is to change and to morph into something different.
I'll explain it sometimes. When you are in the midst of a habit, your brain activity is actually really low. So have you ever gotten home from work and you're like, I did not drive myself home.
Autopilot.
How did I get into my garage? And that's because we were on autopilot, like you said. And that's okay. Hopefully you got home safe. But in order to break habits, you need to usually like clap my hands and say like, hey, like stopping point. We need to get your brain activity higher so that you can pay attention and maybe do something different, right? Awareness, I feel like, is the first step of I am aware that I have this habit. And during the actual habit, I need to somehow make a stopping point of like, wake up, Tara, we're doing something different today. But that's hard.
It is really hard. It requires so much more emotional effort and brain effort and physical effort. And I think so many of us are just drained at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. I know I am. I'm like literally just trying to make it to bed each night most days. And so having even the emotional reserves to be able to do that, that's why so many people try to break a habit or change a habit and fail, right? Because it's hard and it requires so much energy.
And you have to set yourself up for success even within your environment. Mm-hmm. Because like you were talking about, at the end of the day, we sometimes will say decision fatigue, right? Like I have made so many dang decisions today. Like I had a great breakfast and I did pretty good on my lunch. And then I made 7,000 other decisions and I'm like, I'm done.
Yeah.
You have to set your environment up so that you have to do the thing that's unconscious. And ideally that thing is a healthy habit.
I think this is why sometimes I don't want to brush my teeth at the end of the day.
And especially if you were overly restrictive with yourself, maybe my breakfast was a little too healthy, mm-hmm. I'm over it by the end of the day. And that's often, I think, what gets people into cyclical dieting.
Yep.
Of I'm doing good for as long as I can, but this isn't sustainable. And now I'm back to square one.
Yeah. I think people need to remember you don't need to eat perfectly to be healthy, right? People think that they have to do this whole, whatever they're trying to change, right? Every time, the whole time, or just throw it away. I tell parents, like with their kids, over the course of the week, did your kids get some vegetables? Did they get some fruit? I don't take it one day. I don't take it one meal at a time. You have to kind of look at it as a whole. And that's how I think we should give ourselves the same grace of like, as we're making changes, you shouldn't expect it to all be perfect every single day. Think about it week by week, month by month, year by year.
I talk about patterns of eating with adults. The media just loves to ask me questions about like singular ingredients and singular foods. And that's interesting, but I kind of want to be like, that's nice. Can we talk about the pattern of eating that this person has? Because you can have a fabulous diet and one low nutrient food and you're okay. Or you can have a horrific diet and you eating that one quote unquote superfood isn't going to do much for you. So if we want to repair our relationship with food and change our habits, where should we start?
We need to role model flexibility with eating, with our own bodies, with the way we look, the way others look, all of those different things, and not rigidity that there's only one way to do things and there's only one way to be healthy with eating and one way to do all the other things that are a part of living a healthy lifestyle, right? One of my favorite things that I teach my patients after eating disorder treatment and as they go into recovery is the 10 principles of intuitive eating, because I think they're all about flexibility, but addressing like all of us, right? Adjusting our exercise, addressing our mental health, giving ourselves grace, remembering we don't have to be perfect, listening to ourselves as we eat, practicing that mindfulness, figuring out what kind of foods are delicious and bring us joy.
Other things I talk to people about are family meals. We have lots of research, and the number of family meals that makes a difference, statistically, 1 to 2 was the same as 3 or more times a week. 1 to 2.
Right.
It doesn't have to be dinner, right? Maybe you have breakfast on Saturday or you have Sunday night dinner. 1 to 2 meals as a family can absolutely be meaningful. So I'm hoping that that takes pressure off of families and parents to say, like, we don't have to sit down 21 times a week with napkins and plates and talk about
it. Not happening in my house. Let me just say that. Yeah.
And including them. I do not care if your salad doesn't need to be stirred. Just let your 2-year-old stir it. Mm-hmm. They won't know the difference. It's hard for me sometimes because I have toddlers. I'm like, oh, there's going to be flour all over my kitchen island. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, it's okay, Tara. They are going to be proud of what they're making. They're more likely to eat it because they feel a sense of pride in it. Can we go grocery shopping? Okay, I know you don't like broccoli, so what is your favorite vegetable? What vegetable should we put in our cart today? You can put any vegetable in our cart, even if we've never eaten it before. And if you don't want to give your kid a knife or a spoon, they can put napkins on the table, ideally without harming anything.
They can help plate it, mm-hmm. even those little ones and stuff. But just to add on to what you said about family meals, so they help prevent obesity. They help prevent eating disorders, and they also help strengthen your family connection, emotional bond, and they help with mental health and resiliency. Like, who doesn't want those things for your kid, right?
Kids who eat meals with their family have a higher likelihood of higher fruit and vegetable consumption. They have a higher likelihood of being a healthier weight, and they have a higher likelihood of school success. There's also a decreased incidence of behavioral issues. You mentioned decreased frequency of eating disorders. It's also decreased frequency of substance abuse, mm-hmm. and depression, and less likelihood of fast food and sugary beverage consumption. Like, we can talk all day, folks, about just eating one meal as a family if you can.
And it's not a family meal if no one's interacting and talking. So, like, put your devices down, talk about your day, share highs and lows, like, whatever it might be.
And for those adults who live alone, right? Which is lots of people, especially mm-hmm. when you're a young adult or if you're an older adult and you have decided to not have children, et cetera. If you're not a kid, does it matter if you eat meals with other people? What about everyone else?
I would say absolutely. I can't quote any data, but I can extrapolate from all the other benefits of social connection that we know that adults get from being together. I mean, look how catastrophic the COVID-19 epidemic was on our elderly population for their mental and physical health, as they weren't able to have these connections with other people.
Yeah.
I also think of the benefit of preparing or having a meal together. You're sitting down, right? You're not standing while you're eating. We know people tend to consume more when they do that. You're portioning out things. We know that that is beneficial, right? And you're also just talking about life. And that has just got to be beneficial for all the reasons of social connection, depression.
I was just thinking of how often and how many cultures we use food to bring people together.
Exactly.
So it doesn't have to be a party. It doesn't have to be a holiday or a celebration, but can you eat any of your meals? Mm-hmm. Occasionally I have a lunch hour, right? And I may eat it with my colleagues. And that's so much more fun than like scarfing down my salad in front of my keyboard.
And it's just like we lose track of how important those social connections are and making time to sit down, be mindful of eating and engage in those conversations that are meaningful to us and other people.
And we're nourishing ourselves. And whether you are nourishing yourself with nutrition or you are nourishing your soul, as I say, all is good. Thank you for being here again, Dr. Mackey. I think we had a super enjoyable conversation, hopefully a productive one as well.
I had so much fun, Tara. I didn't even feel like we were recording.
I know. Now I feel like I was in therapy for free.
I know, exactly. We got all these endorphin releases. It was fantastic.
Exactly. You can hear Dr. Mackey more on Kids Health Matters. I hope to have you back, Dr. Mackey.
This is fun. I need more therapy.
So can we break free from our childhood habits? Absolutely. But it takes recognizing when our brain starts to go into default mode, switching off that autopilot, and trying to make better choices. And decision fatigue is real. So the more you can make healthy choices, the most convenient ones, like putting fresh berries within arm's reach instead of chips, the better. And remember, progress is more important than perfection. Eating patterns are more important than any one meal. Whether you're raising a child or nurturing your inner child, try to be flexible with eating. Practice thinking about food in neutral terms and be open to trying new things. And communal eating, like a family dinner or meal with friends and loved ones, has so many benefits for your body and your mind. And if you want to hear more of Dr. Mackey, check out Mayo Clinic Kids. It's a podcast from Mayo Clinic Press all about how to keep your kids laughing and thriving. Mayo Clinic Kids is available wherever you get your podcasts. That's all for this episode. But if you've got a question or topic suggestion, you can leave us a voicemail at 507-538-6272. We might even feature your voice on the show. For more on nutrition episodes and resources, check us out online at mayoclinic.org/onnutrition. Thanks for listening. And until next time, eat well and be well.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as medical or legal advice. Always consult with a qualified healthcare provider for any medical questions. The appearance of any guest does not imply an endorsement of them, their employer, or any entity they represent. The views and opinions are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of Mayo Clinic. Reference to any product, service, or entity does not constitute an endorsement of or recommendation by Mayo Clinic.